Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. Here, as always, is David Ramil. And the Heat led 31-22 after the first quarter, but then Dallas went to a zone. Seth Curry got hot, and the Miami Heat lost to the Mavericks 96-89. It's never easy to lose to the Mavericks, David.
No, it still stings. The shadows of 2011 still lingering somewhere there. And despite the fact that it's hardly the same team that beat the Heat in the finals all those years ago, it's just difficult to swallow. Something about Rick Carlisle's angry, scowling face on the sideline, despite the fact that he's widely regarded as a pretty good coach. And, of course, as long as janky-legged Dirk Nowitzki is still taking fadeaways, even at the center position at what is he, 40 years old, 41? I don't know how old he is, something like that. He seems eternal, I guess, but it's still tough to handle a loss, particularly the Mavericks, and particularly when Miami's been playing so well. Mm-hmm. Like, this seemed kind of like a reversion back to the version of the team that they had been prior to that 13-game winning streak.
You thought it was that bad of a loss then? You thought this was a bad loss?
They seem to lose the identity that had been kind of slowly being carved during that win streak, I think. They started off so well, and I felt like not only did they kind of get a little lax, but I think Dallas certainly upped their intensity, particularly on the defensive end. As you pointed out, once they implemented that zone, Miami's second unit really didn't have much of a way of coping with it. They didn't respond particularly well. And defensively, then the Heat started to struggle as well. They allowed Harrison Barnes to take way too many open looks. They started switching badly on defense, and all of a sudden you had a mismatch where Yogi Ferrell was going up against Hassan Whiteside or James Johnson, and Dirk Nowitzki was backing down Goran Dragic or somebody along those lines, and it just seemed like they were getting those shots up. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Curry. I don't know what it was. He just needed very little space, and all of a sudden he was unloading those three-pointers, finished 10 of 17 overall, 5 of 7 from behind the arc, and finished with 29 points. He was absolutely the killer for Dallas.
Game-high score, Curry was. Yeah, he was on fire, but I don't know. I didn't think it was that bad of a loss, and I know that I might be in the minority here because I'm going through my Twitter timeline, as much of a minority that is. But everybody's kind of freaking out, as the internet tends to do. But, look, I'm looking at the stats here, and when it comes down to it, both teams, it wasn't like the Heat played badly, I don't think. Like, they didn't play their best game, but they played, I thought, well enough to win. Like, they got some open looks. Look, they didn't score for the last 4.5 minutes of the game. They didn't score, that's tough. And Dallas went on a 10-0 run during that time, took the lead, and won. But if you just look at the box score, both teams had 13 turnovers, so you can't blame turnovers. Rebounding, the Heat had the edge, 45-42, but basically even. Miami even took more shots. They took 83 shots to Dallas's 76. They didn't, fast break points. They had 13. Dallas had 3. Points in the paint was basically even. They had 38. Dallas had 34. I mean, there's not, one thing that you can look at to say, wow, Dallas really just, they dominated the glass, or Miami committed too many turnovers. Nothing was like that. It was just shots went in for Dallas. And that was,
The free throw disparity was pretty large there. That's true, 21-23 from Dallas, 6-13 from Miami. They didn't hit whatever, few free throw opportunities they did get.
We can talk about the referees in that game if we want, but.
Yeah, Haywood Workman, who ex-NBA, that was Workman, wasn't it? Ex-NBA point guard Workman. He seemed to just have it in for every Heat guard, really. I mean, he called some questionable things on Tyler Johnson and Goran Dragic.
Tyler Johnson guarding, was it Harrison Barnes? Played great defense, hands straight up in the air, and kind of got him with his hip a little bit, but you can't call that. Not when it's Tyler Johnson versus Harrison Barnes. You can't call that. Yeah, even Whiteside got blown for a couple of fouls that I didn't think were there was one foul I think against Curry who was shooting it, and that was questionable because it was a pretty clear flop by Curry. But I mean, look, the Mavericks, they shot 43% in the game, and Miami shot, or I'm sorry, the Dallas shot 50% from 3-point range. Miami shot 34.6%, which is crazy because the Heat over the last 15 games were the number one 3-point shooting team in the league at 41%. That's better than the Spurs, the Warriors, the Cavaliers, the Rockets. 41% over the last 15 games. Tonight, 34.6%. So a big regression there. I thought that the shots were okay. The last 4 minutes, Waiters took an open shot that didn't go in. Wayne Ellington was wide open. His shot didn't go in. Ellington, a tough night for him. 2-6 from the 3-point line. I thought the only bad shot really in those last few minutes was James Johnson taking this step back long two or three. I couldn't quite tell where
it was. It was a three. I remember which one. It kind of hit the side of the rim there.
Yeah. It was a bad shot.
Yeah, particularly. And it was one that you've seen him make on a number of occasions, but he wound up, look, he shot pretty
badly. I don't know if I've seen him make that weird angle three, but I know what you're saying. Like those weird, like bring the ball up and just kind of shoot it from, pull up and shoot it kind of deal. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He finished 4 of 12, 0-for-4 from 3-point range for a total of 8 points. You know, solid everywhere else. Played some pretty good defense on Nowitzki. You know, he was earnestly defending Harrison Barnes. But Barnes in particular, I mean, I think he's just a guy who doesn't have a particularly great reputation considering how his exit from Golden State went down. But, you know, somebody has to put up a lot of points on a bad team. And Dallas hasn't been a particularly bad team, but he looked really, really strong to me. And I know we don't want to focus too much on Dallas, but he seemed particularly good. He just seems, you know, he was dominating with his quick first step. He was able to get to the rim at will. And, I think that really set everybody off. They were doing a lot of similar things, at least I thought, that Miami does. The whole drive and kick game seemed to be really working for them, in addition to that zone defense that really came to kind of set Miami off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Heat outscored Dallas 31-22 in the first quarter. And it looked like it was just going to be another win for the Miami Heat. I mean, the way they were playing. It looked like they could coast. And maybe you're right. Maybe that is what kind of caught up to them. They thought, hey, we're a good team now. We can kind of, you know, we can settle in here. And they couldn't. But you're right. The Mavericks got them off of their rhythm. They went to a zone defense in the second quarter. And after that, the Heat were never able to go back to that drive and kick. I mean, their ball movement in the first quarter was so good. Yeah. And they were never able to get back to that because that their whole ball movement relies on Dragic and Waiters getting to the rim. And a zone defense is designed to keep guys from getting to the rim. I mean, we remember this not really the last few years of Dwayne Wade, but like those early years of Dwayne Wade and those middle years, like kind of the 2005 to like 2010 kind of years where...
Sure, where he was playing at such a high level.
Yeah, where like teams would go to the zone often against the Heat to stop Dwayne Wade specifically to get to the rim and try to force him to take threes, which we know he's allergic to, or used to be until he went to Chicago, whatever. I'm not petty. But that's what Dallas went to, and it knocked off Miami from their game, and Dragic and Waiters, they couldn't get to the rim. All of a sudden, these shots aren't as open as they were, and that was enough. And really, Dallas only did it in the second quarter. They didn't go back to it for a long length of time for the rest of the game, but it was just enough.
Yeah, you know, it's tough watching Miami, particularly when they fall out of a rhythm like that. But you know what never does fall out of the rhythm, Wes?
What?
Using your SeatGeek app.
Oh, you're absolutely right. That's because SeatGeek is the smartest and easiest way to find tickets. It's nothing like being in the arena for the biggest moments of the season with SeatGeek. It's never been easier to get the guaranteed seats that you want for great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the easiest way I found to shop for tickets. I could be anywhere and with just a few taps, I can instantly find the seats for any music or sporting event I want. Actually, my girlfriend and I, we just used it. Jack Johnson is coming to Berkeley.
Huh.
Got Jack Johnson tickets. We saw him last year. He was amazing. We're like, we're doing it again. I think he comes to California like all the time. Like he probably comes to Berkeley every year. So as long as we're out here, I think we're going to use the SeatGeek app to buy Jack Johnson tickets every summer. SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. There are experts on tickets like we're experts about the Miami Heat. That's why you listen to us, and if you listen to us, You should download SeatGeek, because if you do that, you get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. How do you do it? Download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo code, then enter the promo code LOHEAT. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. That's enough for two beers at a Jack Johnson concert.
Nice.
LOHEAT, LOHEAT. That's the promo code. Download the SeatGeek app and enter that promo code LOHEAT today.
So before you go see Jack Johnson, do you make your girlfriend a big plate of banana pancakes?
If I was a romantic, I would. Oh. But I'm just a lazy piece of shit, so I don't.
That's the only song by him I know. That's all I know. I'm glad I was able to incorporate that so seamlessly. There's, but that's why I get paid the big bucks.
There's the one in the Curious George, Upside Down. You know that one. You've definitely heard that.
I'm sure it's in there somewhere. But yeah, I just know the banana pancake song.
While we're off track, I want to ask you.
I love banana pancakes. Thanks for asking.
That's exactly the question. Klay Thompson didn't play in this game, obviously, because he plays for the Warriors. But there was a video of him kind of on Twitter about him folding his pizza, eating a slice of pizza and folding it during the media scrum at the end of the game. The Warriors trot out their players. Reporters weren't like, they don't go into the locker room. So he was trotted out. He's in the hallway. And I guess he got a slice of pizza and there's a bunch of reporters around him. And he's eating this pizza while the reporters talk to him. And Twitter kind of erupted over how Klay Thompson folds his pizza. I wanted to know if you have an opinion on this.
I haven't seen the video, man. Now I feel a little unprepared.
Well, I want to know what your opinion about pizza eating is, basically, is what I'm asking you.
Folding loosely pizza?
Loosely tied into basketball.
You know, I have eaten pizza in so many different ways. I've even been, you know, very cultured at eating it with a fork and knife. I'm a deep dish guy at heart, I think, but I like New York style as well. And I'll fold the occasional slice. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I thought that was perfectly acceptable when it comes to New York style pie.
So you do, like, if you were to break it down percentages, if you had 10 slices of pizza over 10 days, New York style, how many times do you fold it versus not?
I think I'd fold it every one, 10 out of 10.
All right. This is why we're podcast partners. This is why we can get along and have this chemistry, because I think it's the only way to eat New York style pizza, and I got some crap on Twitter about this. I don't know how else you eat it. I've seen people just straight up pick it up and eat it like a triangle.
Right. That's
savage. It's all over the place. I don't know what you're doing. You might as well just take the fork and knife to it at that point.
So. Yeah, I mean, folding the slice of pizza makes it a perfect reservoir for all the greasy goodness that collapses in there. 100%. I mean, that's what it's for. It's basically like you're basically pouring it down your gullet, and that's
pizza wasn't invented to sit at a table and eat. If it was, it wouldn't be pizza. It was invented to be able to just put it in your hand and go. Like,
right?
I'm even a fan of just double slicing and folding. Like, just put another slice on top of the other and folding it. That's
you are a good friend then, because that's exactly I agree 100%. I mean, if I'm especially like, you know, and I'm sure most of our listeners want to hear this, but maybe they have their own stories of a pizza that they can share by contacting us at LockedOnHeat via Twitter or LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. But anyway, you know, when
tell
it's like
your
a work
pizza
function
folding stories. Go ahead.
Yeah. When it's like a work function and they have free pizza, oh, I'll go in there and I'll like be really slick about taking four slices by doubling them up and it just looks like two. But no, they're
wow.
Yeah, of course. You take a plate, you go back to your office or cubicle, it's like, what happened to the pizza? I don't know. I just got two slices.
I just got the standard two slices, just like everybody else.
Or did I? Yeah. I mean.
Well done.
Yeah.
Okay.
These are tricks of the trade that come with experience.
Well, back to this disappointingly depressing Miami Heat loss, because that's going to be the most fun we have this whole podcast. But
it sure will.
Goran Dragic, we do need to talk about him a little bit. 24 points, 10 of 21 shooting, 6 assists. Did have 4 turnovers, so not a good assist to turnover ratio necessarily. But I think the Heat needed every single one of those points and minutes and efforts that Dragic gave. I thought he played good defense. There was one possession against Harrison Barnes. Barnes had the ball in the post, and Dragic didn't give up an inch and forced Barnes to take a turnaround jumper, tough one, that he missed. And just, look, I know Dragic has gotten a lot of crap about his defense over his career. That crap-taking has mostly subsided since he's been with the Heat. And
mostly.
mostly, right? But he's still got that reputation. I think he's, like, don't call me crazy. I think he's, like, a good defender. Like, I don't ever notice times where I'm just like, that was bad defense by Dragic.
There. I think those good moments far outweigh the bad ones at this point. I don't know if he's just, you know, you have to remember the system he played with in Houston and in Phoenix, you know, the 7 seconds or less version that they were running there. And, you know, they weren't really stressing defense all that much. But in Miami, obviously, that's not the case. And I think he's bought into it the way, I mean, he's continued to grow as a player, which you wouldn't think at his age that he would do that. But to me, it seems like he is taking those leaps and bounds defensively. He's doing the best he can. There are moments there where he might lose a player. Maybe he doesn't necessarily make the right switch on defense. These things happen, I think. But,
yeah, who doesn't,
he's,
right?
Yeah, exactly. He is trying. At least that's what I can see. And I think you do as well, that he is giving maximum effort. But offensively, though, it's unquestionable.
Hold on. One other point, because you mentioned that you mentioned the Phoenix thing, and he played shooting guard next to Eric Bledsoe. Like, technically, right. Like, this is a guy that had played shooting guard for most of the beginning of his career. So he's got the size there. You've been next to him. I've been next to him. Like, he's a big guy, and he's strong. And so I think when you see him, you know, body up Barnes is a big dude. Like, even for a small forward, like, he's 6'9", 245, I think. Like, he's big.
He's well built. Yeah,
well built. He plays power forward. He's always been big. I think he was like 230 coming out of UNC, coming out of college. Like, he's just naturally strong and big, and he bodied him up and didn't give up an inch. He's strong. He could switch to guys in the post, like we saw against Barnes and other times. Like, that's basically what all I'm trying to say. And you brought up a good point. Those Houston and Phoenix teams didn't put a premium on defense. And when you go to a team like Miami, who we've talked about, like, there's a 20% boost I think every player gets just by being in Miami and under Eric Spoelstra. And he's definitely benefited from that, and even more so probably. But offensively, you were saying.
No, yeah, I mean, the effort was there. You know, he finished 10 of 21, which is really, really good. Not as great as we've seen, 2 of 5 from three-point range. And like you said, finished for 24 points. It just seemed like he was doing his best, you know, despite the frustration, which was pretty visible there because of some pretty ticky-tack fouls. You know, it didn't seem to bog him down. And I think you can't say the same thing for Hassan Whiteside or Deion Waiters, who struggled, or James Johnson. His effort, Goran's effort, was unquestionable. Like, he's cemented himself as, I think, Miami's best player. And I think one of the better players in the league, to be honest with you. I wonder if, you know, if let's say Miami season continues to move along the way it has over the last few weeks. Let's say they're somehow managed to make their way into the playoff race. Does he get the kind of recognition he deserves? Maybe even get a third team All-NBA nod? I mean, it seems unlikely considering the high level of play around the point guard position.
Yeah.
But he certainly is deserving of it. I mean, we had made a case for him prior to the All-Star game, when there was an injured player, you know, and we were wondering who might make it in his place. And I think Goran Dragic is a legitimate candidate for that, or was a legitimate candidate. And I wonder if he'll get the kind of recognition he deserves, because I think he's been so good. I mean, look, and from an aesthetic perspective, like, I love watching him play. Yeah. Just the speed at which he plays, his ability to knock down those shots. You know, Tony Fiorentino, I think, or was it Fiorentino or Eric? I couldn't remember who on the broadcast was pointing out how difficult a particular shot was when he was running full speed on the fast break, and they just stopped, pulled up, and knocked down a jumper.
Who used to do that? Like, that was the classic Jason Williams shot.
Right.
I love White Chocolate. We love Jason Williams. He used to do that all the time when he came to Miami. I remember him specifically, like, pushing the pace. You and I have talked on a few occasions about how when Jason Williams came and lined up next to Dwayne Wade and started pushing the pace those years, that really, I think, helped unleash Dwayne Wade early in his career.
It did.
And Jason Williams used to do that all the time, to the point where, like, in my driveway, I would practice the Jason Williams shot with my friends in the neighborhood. I would just run up to the 3-point line, which was like the grass by the in the driveway, and I would just scream Jason Williams and throw up a shot and absolutely miss horribly. But Dragic has done that. That's a tough shot, I know from experience. But you were saying, like, this year, like, Dragic maybe 13 long. I don't know. But this year, he's been one of the best players in the NBA. You're absolutely right. Miami, the Heat broadcast showed this graphic at one point. I've got it up in front of me, courtesy of Josh Baumgart.
Baumgart.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The only four players to average 20 plus points and 5 plus assists while shooting 50% at least are Goran Dragic, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, and Nikola Jokic, Denver Nuggets center, who's like, you know, unicorn number one. So, I mean, he's an elite company, right? So,
without a doubt.
He's playing great. Who wasn't
there,
playing?
There still seems to. I'm sorry. No, I'm just wondering because with Dragic, we've talked about this before, but it seems like there's just a stigma against him. That one that I can't understand, and I don't know if it's because he was a career backup. Maybe it's because of his defense, and it could be a racial thing as well. Although clearly it's not for Jokic, who everybody seems enamored with, but rightfully so. This isn't to take anything away from the Joker, who's been playing sensationally in Denver. But I think it's time that across the league and from fans and basketball Twitter alike that you recognize the greatness of Goran Dragic. And I know that we're not supposed to harp on it too much, but I think he's certainly been deserving and he's been a difference maker for the Heat. And it's showing in the level of play across the team during the recent win streak.
22.4 points and 4.9 assists per game in February while shooting 54.7%, 46.3% from three-point range. I mean, the dude is killing it. I mean, I think Eric Reed alluded to possible player of the month for Dragic in February, which he totally deserves, 100%. I haven't compared him to anybody else, but he already gets it. So who didn't have such a great game was Hassan Whiteside. And I tweeted this after the game. 19 points and 19 rebounds for Hassan Whiteside. Whiteside can score 19... And I want you to pick which one of these games he had. Did he score 19 points and have 19 rebounds and still play like garbage? Or did he play like garbage and still have 19 points and 19 rebounds?
Well, that's tough to differentiate. In other words,
are those empty stats, or was he one of these like LeBron on an off night still putting up 20 points? Like, was it an off night that he was still productive, or were these just like empty stats? To me, they looked like empty stats, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because he had not in the first quarter. He had 9 points and I think 6 or 7 rebounds in the first quarter. I want to say 6. But then after that, basically just scored 10 points for the rest of the game, which is not enough. 10 points for a game is enough for a center in some cases, but not when you're going against a small team like the Mavericks who are starting Dirk Nowitzki at center.
Right. Yeah, seemed like he was totally dominating that matchup in the first quarter. I think they alluded to it in the broadcast, and it was pretty evident just from watching the game. His level of energy was one that we're not used to seeing from him at the start of the first quarter.
He looked good.
Yeah. He's always looked like that maybe in the third quarter when other players start to slow down after halftime and he seems to get a second win. Not tonight. Tonight against Dallas, he seems so engaged, playing really well defensively. He's flying all over the court, snatching rebounds out of the air. And he was so good in the first quarter. And I think that's probably a big reason why Miami was able to jump up to such a large lead and establish that kind of early presence. But then he got taken out in the second, and then from that point forward, he just never seemed quite as effective. And that shouldn't have been the case because of the zone or anything like that. He should have still been able to get his points up, but he just seems to lack engagement. And that's been the knock on Hassan for a long time now.
I mean, after those 9 points in the first quarter, he obviously rested for a lot of the second quarter, but then almost went 4 whole minutes without scoring a bucket.
But without Willie Reed, he couldn't really afford to rest either. They were going with that smaller lineup with James Johnson at center. And, I mean, there were some shining moments there, although it didn't really work out during the zone. I didn't mind
the small lineup that much because Dallas was small. But it is worrisome because now Willie Reed is day-to-day with, what, bursitis or something?
And his ankle.
Yeah, whatever bursitis is. And
I think it's like a swelling in the ankle joint. So.
Oh. That doesn't sound good. But, that maybe having James Johnson at small ball 5 is playable against Dallas. Like, ultimately, like I said, it just came down to the referee – not the referees. I shouldn't have said that. The free throw shooting and the three-point shooting. But going forward, when Miami isn't playing small ball teams like Dallas, not having Willie Reed, however much longer he's going to be out, is going to really hurt. So I don't – Maybe we could talk about a few of their options, or we could save that for later. We should save that for later in the week when we're not doing a recap. But and seeing how much longer this Reed stuff goes on for. But ultimately, like, Whiteside's got to be better. Even with 19 points and 19 rebounds, I just feel like those were not impactful. I thought he ran his way into rebounds just because he's big. Like, he had some push shots that just, like, happened to go in. That was just, like...
Yeah, from the free throw line, that he kind of, like, shoved. It was one of his ugly shots all season.
I don't often scream at the television. I screamed at the television. I screamed what? I just screamed what loudly. And I think I woke up my dog. And it went in.
He hit it.
But I can only imagine that, like, if you're Pat Riley, didn't Pat Riley just, like, he was quoted as saying, sometimes under my breath I'll say, take Whiteside out. I don't know if you saw this quote.
I didn't read that. Yeah. I did not see that.
He'll say under his breath, take Whiteside out, and then he'll do something amazing. And I'm like, that's that moment. Like, it's like, I bet you I wanted to see Eric Spoelstra's reaction when Whiteside took that shot, because he probably did the same thing I did. He probably threw his hands up and was like, what? And then went in. And I think, like, I'm not reassured when that goes in, because, you know, 8 times out of 10, it doesn't go in. So...
Those it was weird, right? He seemed like he caught it like right above his hip, and then just kind of like leaned forward and pushed it awkwardly. Like,
Shaq puts this thing towards the backboard, and it just goes.
And
in
it went smoothly too. It wasn't like it hit back. It didn't hit the backboard. Didn't hit rim. It just went smoothly through the net, and it was just like unbelievable to watch him hit. I think there was even a moment there where Eric Reed didn't know how to describe it. Like, at first, he was going to yell, oh, terrible shot. And then it went in. And he's like, Whiteside with the basket. You know, it was like an awkward moment there where you're not quite sure how to respond to that. Because, again, you want to yell and say, what the hell are you doing? But no, it just happened to work out. And look, it was at a key moment there where Miami had, I think they had been struggling to shoot. It had been a couple minutes since they had knocked down a basket. And Dallas was starting to build a large lead. And then Miami was able to come back until the officiating kind of took over and knocked the wind out of their sails.
Any other notes before we wrap this thing up? I think I hit all the talking points. 16 games in a row with 100 points or more broken tonight.
You wonder, you know, we were talking about the small ball lineup, and maybe if it's a night where James Johnson isn't going 4 of 12, you know, hitting 33%, maybe if he hits a couple more shots, it looks a little bit more effective, but it isn't necessarily as much of a concern. So maybe he just had a rough night. I don't know.
To me, that's the story of the game. If Waiters hits a couple more of his open shots, or if Ellington hits those two wide open threes that he missed, this is a completely different game. Miami probably wins the game if just a couple of these other shots go in, but that's often the story of basketball. So I didn't think, I didn't think that the Heat came out and just played like garbage. I thought that, it's a tough game on the road against an opponent that always plays them tough. Miami and Dallas have history. They always play each other tough.
They do.
I didn't think it was that bad of a loss. And I'm looking at the standings. Miami's 1.5 games back of Detroit now. I honestly think that maybe with the exception of Detroit would be probably my only worry at this point. But if Miami goes 500 for the rest of the season, they've got a good chance of getting the 8th seed.
Yeah, I mean, Milwaukee lost, so it was a good night to gain a little ground there and to, you know, kind of build a comfortable lead. Or, you know, it just didn't work out for Miami. But there is a, you know, upcoming game versus the 76ers on Wednesday, so that should be another opportunity for them to gain some ground. And hopefully the outcome will be a little different, especially since since Philadelphia is depleted in the center position with the loss of Joel Embiid, who, you know, has knee trouble now. And then, you know, after Nerlens Noel obviously traded to Dallas, he wasn't much of a factor for Dallas. In fact, Hassan seemed to dominate that matchup. So it'll be interesting to see Whiteside go before.
Yeah, I'm going to wait to call Embiid the future of the NBA too until he can make it a full NBA season without getting hurt. I'm just gonna throw that out there. This is not Locked On 76ers, but just putting that out there. All right.
No, I mean, it's a good concern. Look, he's an interesting topic of conversation, and you know, you wonder. I wonder, are they shutting him down? You think because, you know, Simmons isn't going to play. They've traded Noel. They're not sure what to do with Okafor. Maybe it's just best to just sit out a whole other year. Maybe they're tanking again, kind of quietly.
That's what they pushed Hinkie out for, right? Like, they can't get away with that again. I don't know. Maybe you're right. I don't know. I enjoy conspiracy theories, so. All right. Well, that's all we have for today. Thanks to our sponsor, SeatGeek, the friendliest and smartest way to buy and sell tickets. Use the promo code LOHEAT to get $20 after your first SeatGeek purchase. And whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. Get in touch with the show on Twitter at Locked On Heat or by email, where you can send us mailbag questions, comments, sponsorship opportunities, or pizza preferences. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. And if you aren't subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. When you go to iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
Thanks for the banana pancakes.